Wives and Daughters by Elizabeth Gaskell, dramatized in 9 episodes by Barry Campbell, with Catherine Hurlbut, Angela Pleasance, Tom Wilkinson, Robert Lang, and Thelma Whiteley. Part 3, The New Mama.
The love affairs between a middle-aged couple, Mrs. Kirkpatrick and Mr. Gibson, were prospering well, after the fashion that they liked best, although it might possibly have appeared dull and prosaic to younger people. Lord Cumnor had come down from London in great glee at the news.
I told you so. Now, didn't I say what a good, suitable thing an affair between Gibson and Clare would be? I don't know when I've been so much pleased. Ah, you may despise the trade of matchmaker, my lady, but I'm very proud of it. After this, I shall go on looking out for suitable cases among middle-aged people of my acquaintance. I shan't meddle with young folks. They're so apt to be fanciful. But I've been so successful in this that I do think it's good encouragement to go on.
Go on? With what? Oh, planning.
You can't deny that I planned this match.
I don't think you are likely to do either much good or harm by planning.
It puts it into people's heads, my dear.
Oh, yes, if you speak about your plans to them, of course it does. But in this case, you never spoke to either Mr. Gibson or Clare.
Well, no,
did
I,
you?
No, I never spoke to them, of course not.
Then you must be strongly mesmeric, or your will acted upon theirs if you are to take credit for any part in the affair.
I really can't say. It's no use looking back to what I said or did. I'm very well satisfied with it, and that's enough. And I mean to show them how much I'm pleased. I shall give Clare something towards her rigging out.
Mm-hmm.
And they shall have a wedding breakfast at Ashcombe Manor House. I shall write to Preston about it. When did they say they were to be married, my dear?
I think they'd better wait till Christmas, and I told them so. It would amuse the children going over to Ashcombe for the wedding. And if it's bad weather during the holidays, I'm always afraid of their finding it dull at the Towers. It's very different if there's a good frost and they go out skating and sledging in the park. But these last 2 years, it has been too wet for them, poor dears.
And will the other poor dears be content to wait to make a holiday for your children? To make a Roman holiday? A pope or somebody has a line of poetry like that. To make a Roman holiday.
It's Byron, and it's nothing to do with the subject in hand. I'm surprised at your lordship quoting Byron. He was a very immoral poet.
I saw him take his oath in the House of Lords.
Well, the less said about him, the better. I have told Clare that she had better not think of being married before Christmas, and it won't do for her to be giving up the school in a hurry either.
But Clare did not intend to wait till Christmas, and for this once she carried her point against the will of the Countess. She had a harder task in setting aside Mr. Gibson's desire to have her daughter Cynthia over from France for the wedding. But this, too, she finally, triumphantly achieved. Thus, the wedding would take place in September. Lord Cumnor gave her £100 for her trousseau, though a great part of the money was required to pay off debts at Ashcombe. It was very much to her credit that she preferred clearing herself from debt to purchasing wedding finery. But it was one of the few points to be respected in Mrs. Kirkpatrick that she had always been careful in payment to the shops where she dealt. It was a little sense of duty cropping out. Clare's preparations were thus in a very considerable state of forwardness, while Dr. Gibson had done nothing as yet toward any new arrangement or decoration of his house for his intended. He knew he ought to do something, but what? He finally resolved to take his predicament to the Miss Brownings, two of his oldest and most intimate friends.
And I was thrown into such a turmoil as the result of young Cox, one of my pupils, declaring a passion, if you please, for young Molly.
A passion? To think of Molly as I've held in long clothes coming to have a lover. Well, to be sure, Sister Phoebe, here's a piece of news.
Molly Gibson has got a lover. One may almost say she's had an offer, Mr. Gibson, may not one. And she's but 16.
17, sister, 17. 27 of last June.
Well, have it your own way. 17, if you like to call her so. The fact is still the same. She's got a lover.
I'm sure I hope her course of true love will run smooth.
Ladies, please, Molly knows nothing about it. I haven't even named it to anyone but you two and to one other friend. Well, I trounced Mr. Cox well and did my best to keep his attachment, as he calls it, in bounds. But I was sadly puzzled about what to do about Molly. Miss Eyre was away, and I couldn't leave them in the house together without an older woman.
Mr. Gibson, why did you not send her to us? We would have done anything in our power for you. For your sake, as well as her poor dear mother's.
Thank you. I know you would, Miss Browning, but it wouldn't have done to have had her in Hollingford just at the time of Mr. Cox's effervescence. He's better now. His appetite has come back with double force. After the fasting, he thought it right to exhibit. He had 3 helpings of blackcurrant dumplings yesterday.
Oh, really? Blackcurrant dumplings?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you're most liberal, Mr. Gibson. 3 helpings. And I dare say butcher's meat in proportion.
Oh, I only named it because with such very young men, it's generally seesaw between appetite and love, and I thought the 3rd helping a very good sign. But still, you know, what has happened once may happen again.
Oh, I don't know. Phoebe had an offer of marriage once.
Oh, hush, sister. It might hurt his feelings to have
it. Nonsense, child. It's 25 years ago. And his eldest daughter is married herself.
I own he has not been constant. All men are not like you, Mr. Gibson, faithful to the memory of their first love.
Well, at any rate, I thought I must do something to protect Molly from such affairs while she was so young. And then Miss Eyre's nephew fell ill of the scarlet fever.
Oh, how is the poor little fellow?
Oh, worse, better. It doesn't signify to what I've got to say now. The fact was, Miss Eyre couldn't come back to my house for some time, and I cannot leave Molly altogether at Hamley.
Well, I see now why there was that sudden visit to Hamley. Upon my word, it's quite a romance.
I do like hearing of a love affair.
Then, if you let me get on with my story, you shall hear mine.
Yours?
Bless us and save us whatever next.
My marriage, I hope. And that's what I came to speak to you about.
Oh, Mr. Gibson.
Of course, it's been an anxious thing for me to decide who I should ask to be the mistress of my family and the mother of my girl. But I think I've decided at last.
Oh, Mr. Gibson.
The lady I have chosen...
Tell us at once.
The lady I've chosen is,
Well?
It's Mrs. Kirkpatrick.
What? She used to be the governess at the Towers?
Yes.
That the Countess makes so much of?
Yes, she is much valued by the family, and deservedly so. She keeps a school now at Ashcombe and is accustomed to housekeeping. She's brought up the young ladies at the Towers and has a daughter of her own, and therefore it is probable she will have a kind, motherly feeling towards Molly.
She's a very elegant-looking woman. A very pretty woman.
Now, listen, sister, what has her elegance and prettiness to do with the affair? Did you ever know a widower marry again for such trifles as these? It's always from a sense of duty of one kind or another, isn't it, Mr. Gibson? They want a housekeeper, or they want a mother for their children, or they think their last wife would have liked it.
You must have it your own way, Miss Browning. Settle my motives for me. I don't pretend to be quite clear about them myself, but I am clear in wishing heartily to keep my old friends and for them to love my future wife for my sake. I don't know any 2 women in the world except for Molly and Mrs. Kirkpatrick I regard as much as I do you. Besides, I want to ask you if you'll let Molly come and stay with you till after my marriage.
Oh, you might have asked us before you asked Madam Hamley. We are your old friends, and we were her mother's friends too, though we're not county folk.
Now, that's unjust, and you know it is.
I don't know. You're always with Lord Hollingford when you can get at him, much more than you're ever with Mr. Goodenough or Mr. Smith. And you're always going over to Hamley Hall.
I seek Lord Hollingford as I should seek such a man, whatever his rank or position might be, usher to a school, carpenter, shoemaker, if it were possible for them to have a similar character of mind developed by similar advantages. Mr. Goodenough is a very clever attorney with strong local interests and not a thought beyond.
Well, don't go on arguing. It always gives me a headache. I didn't mean what I said. But that's enough, isn't it? I'll retract anything sooner than be reasoned with. Now, where were we before you began your arguments?
About dear little Molly coming to pay us a visit.
Yes, I should have asked you at first, only Mr. Cox was so rampant with his love. I didn't know what he might do or how troublesome he might be, both to Molly and to you. But he's calmed down now. Absence has a very tranquilizing effect. And I think Molly may be in the same town with him without any consequences beyond a few sighs every time she's brought to his mind by his meeting her. But I've another favour to ask you. So you see, it would never do for me to argue with you, Miss Browning, when I ought to be a humble suppliant. Hmm? Something must be done to the house to make it all ready for the future Mrs. Gibson. It wants papering and painting shamefully, and I should think some new furniture, but I'm sure I don't know what. Would you be so very kind as to look over the place and see how far £100 will go? I'll leave it to you entirely, if you'll only be kind enough to help an old friend.
Time was speeding on. If anything was to be done to the house, it must be done at once. Indeed, in several ways, Mr. Gibson's arrangements with Miss Browning had not been made too soon. At Hamley Hall, the squire had heard that his son Osborne might probably return home for a few days before going abroad. And though the growing intimacy between Roger and Molly did not alarm him in the least, yet he was possessed of a very hearty panic lest his heir might take a fancy to the surgeon's daughter, and was greatly relieved when Molly removed to the Miss Brownings, who immediately began to make inquiries as to every possible affair at the Hall.
Well, you seem to have seen a great deal of Mr. Roger, Molly.
Yes, he was very kind to me.
I dare say you will soon be going to the Hall again. He's not the eldest son, you know. Phoebe, don't make my head ache with your eternal 18-19. Attend to the conversation. Molly is telling us how much she saw of Mr. Roger and how kind he was to her. Well, I've always known he was a very nice young man, my dear. Tell us some more about him. Phoebe, attend. How was he kind to you, Molly?
Oh, he told me what books to read. And one day he made me notice how many bees I saw.
Bees, child? What do you mean? Bumblebees? Well, either you or he must have been crazy.
No, not at all. There are more than 200 kinds of bees in England, and he wanted me to notice the difference between them and flies.
Oh.
Miss Browning, I can't help seeing what you fancy, but it is very wrong. It is all a mistake. I won't speak another word about Mr. Roger of Hamley at all if it puts such silly notions into your head.
Silly notions?
Tighty. Here's a young lady to be lecturing her elders. Silly notions, indeed. In your head, it seems. And let me tell you, Molly, you're too young to let your mind be running on lovers.
I never said what the silly notion was, Miss Browning. Did I now, Miss Phoebe? Don't you see, dear Miss Phoebe, it's all her own interpretation, and according to her fancy, this talk of lovers.
I'm sure I don't know anything about it, my dear. It seems to me that what Sally was saying was very true, and I think, love, you misunderstood her. Or perhaps she misunderstood you. Oh, well, I may be misunderstanding it altogether, so we'd better not talk any more about it.
Silly notions, indeed.
Who's there?
It's me, child.
Is something the matter?
I was afraid you were asleep, Molly, but I wanted to say to you, we've got wrong today somehow, and I think perhaps it was my doing. It's as well Phoebe shouldn't know, for she thinks me perfect, and when there's only two of us, we get along better if one of us thinks the other can do no wrong. But I rather think I was a little cross. We'll not say any more about it, Molly, only we'll go to sleep friends, and friends we'll always be, child, won't we?
Oh, Miss Browning.
Now, give me a kiss. And don't cry and swell your eyes up and put out your candle carefully.
Oh, I was wrong. It was my fault.
Fiddlestickens. Don't contradict me. I say it was my fault. And I won't hear another word about it. Oh, by the way, my dear, I was thinking, who is to buy you a bridesmaid's dress?
I don't know. I suppose I am to be a bridesmaid, but no one has spoken to me about my dress.
Then I shall ask your papa in the morning.
Please don't. He must have spent a great deal of money just now. Besides, I would rather not be at the wedding if they'll let me stay away.
Nonsense, child. Why, all of Hollingford would be talking of it. You must go, and you must be well dressed, for your father's sake.
But Mr. Gibson had thought of Molly's dress. He had commissioned his future wife to get her what was requisite. And presently a very smart dressmaker came to try on a dress, which was both so simple and so elegant as at once to charm Molly. On the night before the wedding, Mr. Gibson and Molly drove over to Ashcombe. They were to be Mr. Preston's, or rather my lord's, guests at the manor house. Mr. Preston was very handsome and knew it. He was a fair man, with light brown hair and whiskers, grey, roving, well-shaped eyes, and a figure rendered easy and supple by the athletic exercises in which his excellence was famous, and which had procured him admission into much higher society than he was otherwise entitled to enter. He had his own private reasons for wishing to get up a flirtation with Molly just at this time. He had much amused himself with the widow when she first came to Ashcombe. And besides, he had really a strong passion for someone else, someone who would be absent, and that passion it was necessary for him to conceal.
How charming you look, Miss Gibson. Do come along in. Your father is not down yet. This room is that which Lady Harriet uses when she comes here with her father for a day or two.
Does she often come here, Mr. Preston?
Not often, but I fancy she likes being here when she does. Perhaps she finds it an agreeable change after the more formal life she leads at the Towers.
Oh, I should think it was a very pleasant house to stay at.
Yes, oh yes. I'm very much obliged to you, Miss Gibson. I was afraid a young lady like you might perceive all the incongruities of a bachelor's home. In general, I live pretty much in the room in which we shall dine. And I have a sort of agent's office in which I keep books and papers and receive callers on business.
How interesting. Oh, but here is Papa.
I'm sorry to be a little behindhand, Preston.
Not at all, Mr. Gibson. Miss Gibson is the most delightful company.
The dinner is served, sir.
Capital. Allow me, Miss Gibson. It's only humble bachelor fare, I'm afraid. Perhaps after dinner you will allow me to show you the rest of the house. Your father, if I may venture to say so without giving any offence, Miss Gibson, is looking just a little tired, a little careworn this evening.
Yes, poor Papa.
Perhaps it is the thought of his wedding tomorrow.
Perhaps.
Ah, but see here. This is said to be Mademoiselle de Saint-Quentin, a great beauty at the French court. And this is Madame Dubonny. They are very fine miniatures, are they not? Tell me, do you see any likeness in Madame Dubonny to anyone you know?
No, I never saw anyone half so beautiful.
But don't you see the likeness? In the eyes, particularly.
I'm sorry, but
it constantly reminds me of Miss Kirkpatrick.
Oh, does it? Oh, I am so glad. I've never seen her, so of course I couldn't find out the likeness. Well, you know her then, do you? Oh, please tell me about her.
She's very beautiful.
And besides... Oh, go on, please.
What do you mean by besides?
Oh, I suppose she is very clever and accomplished.
Well, she's clever, naturally. She has picked up accomplishments. But she has so much charm about her, one forgets what she herself is in the halo that surrounds her. You ask me all this, Miss Gibson, and I answer truthfully, or else I should not entertain one lady with my enthusiastic praises of another.
Oh, I don't see why not. Besides, if you wouldn't do it in general, I think you ought to do it in my case. For you perhaps don't know... But she is coming to live with us when she leaves school. And we are really nearly the same age. So it will almost be like having a sister.
So she is to live with you, is she? And when is she to leave school? I thought she would surely be at this wedding, but I was told she was not to come. When is she to leave school?
I think it is to be at Easter. You know she is at Boulogne, and it is a long journey for her to come alone. Papa wished for her to be at the wedding very much indeed.
And her mother prevented it. I understand.
No, it wasn't her mother. It was the French schoolmistress who didn't think it desirable. Mm.
It comes to pretty much the same thing. And she's to return and live with you after Easter?
I believe so. Is she a grave or a merry person?
Never very grave, as far as I have seen of her. Sparkling would be the word for her, I think. Do you ever write to her? If you do, pray remember me to her and tell her how we have been talking about her, you and I.
I never write to her.
I see. Well, perhaps we had better rejoin your father in the drawing room, Miss Gibson.
The wedding went off much as such affairs do. Lord Cumnor and Lady Harriet drove over from the Towers. Lord Cumnor came to officiate as the bride's father, and Lady Harriet as a sort of amateur bridesmaid to share Molly's duties, as she called it. They went from the manor house in two carriages, Mr. Preston and Mr. Gibson in one, and Molly, to her dismay, shut up with Lord Cumnor and Lady Harriet in the other.
We mustn't crush this pretty dress of yours. Put it over Papa's knee.
Oh, well, Lady Harriet...
He doesn't mind in the least.
What, my dear? Oh, a white dress? No, to be sure not. I rather like it. Besides, going to a wedding, who minds anything? It would be different if we were going to a funeral, eh?
Yes, I dare say it's something of a trial to you, this second marriage of your father's. But you'll find Claire the most amiable of women. She always let me have my own way, and I've no doubt she'll let you have yours.
I mean to try and like her. I've seen very little of her yet.
Why, it's the very best thing for you that could have happened, my dear. You're growing up into a young lady, and a very pretty young lady, too, if you'll allow an old man to say so. And who's so proper as your father's wife to bring you out and show you off and take you to balls and that kind of thing?
Poor child, the thought of it is all too much for her.
But you'll like having Cynthia Kirkpatrick for a companion, shan't you, my dear?
Oh, very much. Do you know her?
Oh, I've seen her over and over again when she was a little girl, and once or twice since. She's the prettiest creature that you ever saw, and with eyes that mean mischief, if I'm not mistaken. But Claire kept her spirit under pretty well when she was staying with us.
Well, here we are. And quite a little gathering, too. Now, be careful of your dress, my dear.
It was pleasant to be led to the altar by a belted earl, and pleasant to have his daughter as a volunteer bridesmaid. Mrs. Kirkpatrick, in this flush of small gratifications and on the brink of matrimony with a man whom she liked, and who would be bound to support her without any exertion of her own, looked beamingly happy and handsome. A little cloud came over her face at the sight of Mr. Preston. The sweet perpetuity of her smile was rather disturbed as he followed in Mr. Gibson's wake, but his face never changed, and he bowed to her gravely, and then seemed absorbed in the service. 10 minutes, and all was over. It was during the wedding breakfast that Molly found out, to her dismay, that she was to return to the Towers that evening with Lord Cumnor and Lady Harriet. In the meantime, Lord Cumnor had business to do with Mr. Preston, and after the happy couple had driven off on their week's holiday tour, Molly was to be left alone with the formidable Lady Harriet.
Well, what a busy day you've had, young lady. Now, don't be shy. Come and sit here by me. You know, young Miss Gibson, I like you. You're a little wild creature, and I want to tame you. Molly. What a nice, soft-sounding name. People in the last century weren't afraid of homely names. Now we're all so smart and fine. No more Lady Betty's now. I almost wonder they haven't rechristened all the worsted and knitting cotton that bears her name.
I didn't know there was a Lady Betty's cotton.
That proves you don't do fancy work. Your fine Claire will set you to it, though. She used to set me a piece after piece. Knights kneeling to ladies, impossible flowers. But I must do her justice to add that when I got tired of them, she finished them herself. I wonder how you two will get on together.
So do I.
I used to think I managed her till one day an uncomfortable suspicion arose that all the time she had been managing me. Still, it's easy work to let oneself be managed. At any rate, till one wakens up to the consciousness of the process, and then it may become amusing if one takes it in that light.
I should hate to be managed. I'll try and do what she wishes, for Papa's sake, if she'll only tell me outright. But I should dislike to be trapped into anything.
Now, I am too lazy to avoid traps, and I rather like to remark the cleverness with which they've been set. But then, of course, I know that if I choose to exert myself, I can break through the withes of green flax with which they try to bind me. Now, perhaps you won't be able to.
I don't quite understand what you mean.
Oh, well, never mind. I dare say it's as well that you shouldn't. The moral of all I've been trying to say is be a good girl and suffer yourself to be led, and you'll find your new stepmother the sweetest creature imaginable. You'll get on capitally with her. How you get on with her daughter is another affair, but I dare say very well.
Mr. Preston said she is very sparkling.
Did he indeed? I cannot bear that sort of person.
Oh, Mr. Preston?
Giving himself airs of gallantry towards one to whom his simple respect is all his duty. I can talk to one of my father's labourers with pleasure, while with a man like that underbred fop I'm all over thorns and nettles. What is it the Irish call that style of creature?
I don't know.
Ah, that shows you've never read Miss Maria Edgeworth's tales. I'll lend them to you while you're all alone.
I'm not alone. I'm not at home, but on a visit to Miss Browning's.
Then I'll bring them to you. I know the Miss Brownings. Pexy and Flapsy, I used to call them. I like the Miss Brownings. One gets enough respect from them, at any rate. And I've always wanted to see the kind of menage of such people.
Your ladyship keeps speaking of the sort of
class of people to which I belong as if it were a kind of strange animal you were talking about. Yet you talk so openly to me that...
Well, go on. I like to hear you. You think me in your heart a little impertinent now, don't you?
Yes, a little. But I think you a great many other things.
Well, we'll leave the other things for the present. Don't you see, little one, I talk after my kind, just as you talk after your kind. It's only on the surface with both of us.
Why, I dare say some of your good Hollingford ladies talk of the poor people in a manner which they would consider impertinent in their turn if they could hear it. After all, it is only a way of speaking. I ought not to have used it to you, but somehow I separate you from all these Hollingford people.
But why? I am one of them.
Yes, you are, but... Now, don't reprove me again for impertinence. Most of them are so unnatural in their exaggerated respect and admiration when they come up to the towers and put on so much pretense by way of fine manners that they only make themselves objects of ridicule. You, at least, are simple and truthful. And that's why I separate you in my mind from them and... Ah, here's tea.
Ah, Lady Harriet. Lord Cumnor said I might find you here. Will you allow me the pleasure of showing you some alterations I have made in the flower garden, in which I have tried to consult your taste, before it grows dark?
Thank you, Mr. Preston. I will ride over with Papa some day, and we will see if we approve of them.
Will not you come out, Miss Gibson, and see something of the gardens? You haven't been out at all, I think, excepting to church.
It is true that
I cannot spare Miss Gibson. If she would like to see the place, I will bring her over some day myself.
I see. Thank you, Lady Harriet. If you will excuse me.
I dare say it's my own lazy selfishness has kept you indoors all day against your will, but at any rate you are not to go out walking with that man.
Oh, but
I have an instinctive aversion to him. Not entirely instinctive, either. He's a very clever land agent and does his duty by Papa, and I don't choose to be taken up for libel. But remember what I say.
Yes.
Now, after tea it will be time to return to the Towers. Would you rather come in and dine with us at the Towers? We should send you home, of course. Or go straight home. Tell the truth now and evermore. Truth is generally amusing, if nothing else.
I would rather go back to the Miss Brownings at once, please.
As you wish. I shall come some day soon and bring you a load of Miss Edgeworth's tales and make further acquaintance with Pexy and Flapsy.
Oh, no, please, don't. You must not come. Indeed, you must not.
Why not?
Because I would rather not. Because I think that I ought not to have anyone coming to see me who laughs at the friends I'm staying with and calls them names.
My dear little woman, I'm very sorry to have called them names. Very, very sorry to have hurt you. But I promise you to be respectful to them in word and deed and in every thought if I can. You'll let me then, won't you?
Excuse me, lady.
Ah, tea at last.
On Molly's return, the Miss Brownings were full of welcome, full of curiosity. All through the long day, they had been missing their bright young visitor. What had become of Molly during all the afternoon had been a great perplexity to them, and they were very much oppressed with a sense of the great honour she had received in being allowed to spend so many hours alone with Lady Harriet. Molly began to feel as if there was some foundation for Lady Harriet's inclination to ridicule the worship paid by the good people of Hollingford to their liege lord, and to wonder with what tokens of reverence they would receive Lady Harriet if she came to pay her promised visit. But before Lady Harriet's call was paid, Molly received another visitor, Mr. Roger Hamley.
I've brought you the wasp's nest, I promised you, Miss Gibson. There has been no lack of such things this year. We've taken 74 on my father's land alone.
Goodness!
And one of the labourers, a poor fellow who ekes out his wages by beekeeping, has had a sad misfortune. The wasps have turned the bees out of his hive and eaten up the honey.
Oh, greedy little birds. I'm sure they deserve fire and brimstone more than the poor dear innocent bees. And then it seems so ungrateful of mankind. We're going to feast on the honey.
Yes, quite. I have also brought you a note from my mother.
Thank you.
My brother and I are going with my father to an agricultural meeting at Canonbury on Thursday. And, Miss Browning, my mother desires me to say how much obliged she would be if you would spare Miss Gibson for the day. Oh, she was very anxious to ask for the pleasure of your company, too, but she really is so poorly that we persuaded her to be content with Miss Gibson.
sure she's very kind.
Then I may go, Miss Brown.
You'll be sure, my dear. Write a pretty note and tell Mrs. Hamley how much obliged to her we are for thinking.
Oh, I'm afraid I cannot wait for a note. I must take a message instead, for I have to meet my father at 1 o'clock, and it is close upon it now. Then we may count on you on Thursday, Miss Gibson. I will send the carriage for you. Oh,
you may indeed. I look forward to seeing dear Mrs. Hamley once more.
Brilliant with autumnal flames and glittering dewdrops on the gossamer web that stretched from scarlet to blue and thence to purple and yellow petals.
What? Osborne, back so soon.
Yes, I'm back again, Mother. Bullocks, I find, are not in my life. I only disappointed my father in not being able to appreciate their merit, and I'm afraid I didn't care to learn. And the smell was insufferable.
Oh, my dear boy, don't make apologies to me. Keep them for your father. I'm only too glad to have you back. Miss Gibson, this tall fellow is my son Osborne, as I dare say you've guessed. Osborne, Miss Gibson.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Molly was trying to reconcile the ideal with the real. The ideal was agile yet powerful, with Greek features and an eagle eye. The real was almost effeminate in movement, though not in figure. He had the Greek features, but his blue eyes had a cold, weary expression in them. He was extremely attentive to his mother, yet it struck on the shrewd, if simple, girl that Osborne was mentally squinting at her in the conversation which was directed to Mrs. Hamley. But before the afternoon was ended, without there having been any direct conversation between Osborne and Molly, she had reinstated him on his throne in her imagination. Before Molly left, the squire and Roger returned from Canonbury.
Osborne here? Why the deuce couldn't you tell us you were coming home? I looked about for you everywhere just as we were going into the ordinary. I wanted to introduce you to Grantley and Fox and Lord Forrest, men from the other side of the county whom you ought to know. And Roger there missed about half his dinner hunting about for you. And all the time you stole away and were quietly sitting here with the women. I wish you'd let me know the next time you make off. I've lost half my pleasure in looking at as fine a lot of cattle as I ever saw, with thinking you might be having one of your old attacks of faintness.
I should have had one, Father, I think, if I'd stayed longer in that atmosphere. But I'm sorry if I caused you anxiety.
Well. And Roger, too. There I've been sending him here and sending him there all the afternoon.
Oh, Roger, I'm sorry.
I didn't mind it, sir. I was only sorry you were so uneasy. I thought Osborne had gone home, for I knew it wasn't much in his way. Well, Miss Gibson, and how are you getting on with Huber's book? Don't you find it very interesting?
I'm afraid I haven't read much. The Miss Brownings like me to talk, and Miss Browning likes me to go with her to Father's house. And I know it sounds nothing, but it does take up a deal of time.
When is your father coming home, my dear?
Next Thursday, I believe. He cannot stay long away.
Oh, I shall ride over and pay my respects to Mrs. Gibson. I shall come as soon as I may. Your father has been a very kind friend to me ever since I was a boy. And when I come, I shall expect my pupil to be very diligent.
We have had the most delightful conversation, Osborne and Molly and I, this afternoon.
Well, I think it's high time we saw Miss Gibson home. The Miss Brownings will be wondering what's become of her.
Oh.
Not that we want to lose your company, my dear.
Well, yes, I think it is time. Goodbye, dear Mrs. Hamley.
Molly, my dear.
Oh, Molly.
Why, Miss Phoebe, whatever is the matter?
I thought you'd never come back. Such a piece of news. Sister has gone to bed. She's had a headache with excitement, I think. But she says it's new bread. Come upstairs softly, my dear, and I'll tell you what it is. Who do you think has been here with us, drinking the tea with us, too, in the most condescending manner for Lady Harriet? Yes! Why, how did you guess it? But, after all, her call, at any rate, in the first instance, was upon you. Oh, dear Molly, if you're not in a hurry to go to bed, let me sit down quietly and tell you all about it. For my heart jumps into my mouth still when I think of how I was caught.
She, that is, her ladyship, left the carriage at the George and took to her feet to go shopping. And Sister was taking 40 winks. And I was sitting with my gown up above my knees and my feet on the fender, pulling out my grandmother's lace. No, the worst has yet to be told. I had taken off my cap, for I thought it was getting dusk and no one would come. And there I was in my black silk skull cap when Nancy put her head in and whispered, "There's a lady downstairs, a real grand one by her talk." And in there came my Lady Harriet. It was some time before I forgot I had never a cap on. Well, her ladyship, as soon as she saw the state of the case, came and knelt down on the rug by me and begged my pardon for having followed Nancy upstairs without waiting for permission, and wanted to know where you were and when the happy couple would be back, till Sister wakened. And without turning her head to see who it was, she said, quite sharp, "Buzz, buzz, buzz, when will you learn that whispering is more fidgeting than talking out loud? I've not been able to sleep at all for the chatter you and Nancy have been keeping up all this time." So I went to her and said in a low voice, "Sister, it's her ladyship and me that has been conversing." "Ladyship here, have you lost your wits, Phoebe, that you talk such nonsense, and you in your skull cap too?" But by this time she was sitting up, and she saw Lady Harriet sitting on our rug, smiling. Oh, my word! She was on her feet directly, and she dropped her curtsy and made her excuses for sleeping as fast as might be, while I went off to put on my best cap. And when I came back, Sister had ordered tea for her ladyship, and she was quite struck with our tea and asked where we got it, for she said she'd never tasted any like it before. And I told her we only gave 3 shillings and 4 pence a pound for it. And she said she would send us some of hers, all the way from Russia or Prussia or some out-of-the-way place. And if we liked hers best, she could get it for us at 3 shillings a pound.
Oh, goodness.
And she left her love for you. And though she was going away, you were not to forget her.
Oh.
Sister thought such a message would set you up too much. But I said a message is a message, and it's on Molly's own shoulders if she gets set up by it. Let us show her an example of humility, Sister, though we have been sitting cheek by jowl in such company. So Sister humped and said she had a headache and went to bed. And now, you may tell me your news, my dear.
So Molly told her small events, which, interesting as they might have been at other times to the gossip-loving and sympathetic Miss Phoebe, were rather pale in the stronger light reflected from the visit of an earl's daughter. On Tuesday afternoon, Molly returned home, to the home which was already strange, and what Warwickshire people would call unked. New paint, new paper, new colours, grim servants dressed in their best and objecting to every change. And later that afternoon, the new mamma.
And the 2 small parcels to the kitchen. Oh, and Betty, tell cook I probably wish to discuss several new recipes with her early tomorrow.
No, my love, we can embrace each other in peace. Oh, dear, how tired I am. My spirits are so easily affected with fatigue. But your dear papa has been kindness itself. Oh, dear, what an old-fashioned bed. But it doesn't signify. By and by we'll renovate the house, won't we, my dear? And you'll be my little maid tonight and help me to arrange a few things, for I'm just worn out with the day's journey.
I ordered a sort of tea dinner to be ready for you. Shall I go and tell them to send it in?
I'm not sure if I can go downstairs again tonight. It would be very comfortable to have a little table brought in here and sit in my dressing gown by this cheerful fire. But to be sure, there's your dear papa. I really don't think he would eat anything if I were not there. One must not think about oneself, you know. Yes, I'll come down in a quarter of an hour.
But Papa has gone out.
Gone out?
There was a note awaiting him with an immediate summons to Mr. Cravensmith, who is dangerously ill.
I see. Perhaps I will have a little table in here after all, and then perhaps you would be so kind as to help me unpack. Ah, Molly, I feel so lonely, darling, in this strange house. Do come and be with me. I think your dear papa might have put off his visit to Mr. Cravensmith for just this one evening.
But Mr. Cravensmith couldn't put off his dying.
You droll girl. But if Mr. Smith is dying, as you say, what's the use of your father's going off to him in such a hurry? Does he expect any legacy or anything of that kind?
I don't quite know that he is dying. The man who brought the note said so, and Papa can sometimes do something to make the last struggle easier.
What dreary knowledge of death you have learned for a girl of your age. Really, if I had heard all these details of your father's profession, I doubt if I could have brought myself to have him.
He doesn't make the illnesses or the death. He does his best against them. I call it a very fine thing to think of what he does or tries to do. And you will think so, too, when you see how he is watched for and how people welcome him.
Well, don't let us talk any more of such gloomy things tonight. I think I shall go to bed at once. I'm so tired. If you will only sit by me till I get sleepy, darling. If you will talk to me, the sound of your voice will send me off.
Molly got a book and read her stepmother to sleep, preferring that to the harder task of keeping up a continual murmur of speech. Then she stole downstairs and went to the dining room, where the fire was gone out, purposely neglected by the servants to mark their displeasure at their new mistress's having had her tea in her own room. Molly managed to light it, however, before her father came home. Then she knelt down on the hearthrug, gazing into the fire in a sad, dreamy reverie.
What, Goosey? Not a bed yet.
How is Mr. Craven Smith?
Oh, he's dead. Oh. He just recognized me. He was one of my first patients when I came to Hollingford. And where's the new mama?
She was tired and went to bed early. Oh, Papa, must I call her Mama?
I should like it. Why shouldn't you call her Mama? I'm sure she means to do the duty of a mother to you. We may all make mistakes, and her ways may not be quite all at once our ways. But at any rate, let's start with a family bond between us. Do you hear me, Molly? Molly. Oh, well. Tell me about your time with the Miss Brownings.
I will call her Mama.
You won't be sorry for it, Molly, when you come to lie as poor Craven Smith did tonight.
Yes, Papa.
And that's my little girl.
Among the county people, as Mrs. Gibson termed them, who called upon her as a bride, were the two young Mr. Hamleys. The squire, their father, had done his congratulations, as far as he ever intended to do them, to Mr. Gibson himself when he came to the hall. But Mrs. Hamley, unable to go and pay visits herself, made her sons ride over to Hollingford with cards and apologies. As soon as they had left, Mrs. Gibson began her usual comments on the departed visitors.
I do like that Osborne Hamley. What a nice fellow he is. Somehow I always do like eldest sons. He will have the estate, won't he? I shall ask your dear papa to encourage him to come about the house. He will be a very good, very pleasant acquaintance for you and Cynthia. The other is but a loutish young fellow, to my mind. There is no aristocratic bearing about him. The estate is entailed, is it not?
I know nothing about it.
Do you know, I almost think I must get dear Papa to give a dinner party and ask Osborne Hamley. I should like him to feel at home in this house. It would be something cheerful for him after the dullness and solitude of Hamley Hall. For the old people don't visit much, I believe.
He's going back to Cambridge next week.
Is he? Well, then, we'll put off our little dinner till Cynthia comes home at the New Year. I should like to have some young society for her, poor darling, when she returns.
As the weeks went by, many were the domestic changes which Mrs. Gibson effected in her new home. Mr. Gibson had made up his mind before his marriage to yield in trifles and be firm in greater things. But the differences of opinion about trifles arose every day, and were perhaps more annoying than if they had related to things of more consequence. He repeatedly reminded himself of his wife's good qualities, and comforted himself by thinking that they should work together as time rolled on. Molly, however, found her new mama's innovations harder to bear with.
Molly, my dear, I have been thinking. I must get this drawing room all new furnished first. Then I mean to fit up Cynthia's room and yours just alike.
Are you going to new furnish that room?
Yes, and yours too, darling, so don't be jealous.
Please, Mama, not mine.
Yes, dear, you shall have yours done as well. A little French bed and new paper will make it look quite different.
But I don't want it to look different. I like it as it is.
What nonsense, child. I never heard anything more ridiculous. Most girls would be glad to get rid of furniture any fit for the lumber room.
It was my own mama's before she was married.
It is very much to your credit that you should have such feelings, I'm sure. But don't you think sentiment may be carried too far? Why, we should have no new furniture at all. And should have to put up with worm-eaten horrors. Besides, my dear, Hollingford will seem very dull to Cynthia after pretty, gay France. And I want to make the first impressions attractive.
But can't you do Cynthia's room and not mine? Please let mine alone.
No, indeed. I couldn't agree to that. Only think, what would be said of me by everybody? Petting my own child and neglecting my husband's. I couldn't bear it.
No one need know.
In such a tickle-tackle place as Hollingford. Really, Molly, you are either very stupid or very obstinate, or else you don't care what hard things may be said about me. And all for a selfish fancy of your own. No, I owe myself the justice of acting in this matter as I please. Everyone shall know I am not a common stepmother. Every penny I spend on Cynthia, I shall spend on you too. So it's no use talking any more about it.
But we've had so many changes. Betty gone and Cork, and now Mr. Cox has gone too, to nurse his sick uncle.
My dear girl, Betty might have stayed forever if she had only attended to all my wishes. And I am not unreasonable, am I? Oh. And as for Cook, she not only did not like the trouble of late dinners, but, if you please, objected to my new French recipes on religious grounds. What nonsense. Oh, by the way, I received such an amusing letter from Lady Harriet yesterday. She is at Bath with dear Lady Cumnor, you know. Well, she sends you her kindest regards for some reason. And, oh, yes, she inquires as to how the Miss Brownings liked the tea she had sent. This last, I'm afraid, I don't understand at all. Why did she send them tea?
Lady Harriet called at the Miss Brownings while I was away from the house at Hamley Hall. Well, Lady Harriet took tea with them and promised to send them some of her own blend. But she really called to see me. About some books, I think.
What nonsense. Lady Harriet only went to see you out of a desire of amusement. She would only make fun of the Miss Brownings, and those two will be quoting her and talking about her just as if she was their intimate friend.
I don't think she did make fun of them. She really seemed as if she'd been very kind.
And you suppose you know her ways better than I do, who have known her these 15 years? I tell you, she turns everyone into ridicule who does not belong to her set. Why, she used always to speak of the Miss Brownings as Pecksy and Flapsy.
She promised me she would not.
Promised you? Lady Harriet? What do you mean?
Only, she spoke of them as Pecksy and Flapsy, and when she talked of coming to call on me at their house, I asked her not to come if she was going to make fun of them.
Upon my word, with all my long acquaintance with Lady Harriet, I should never have ventured upon such impertinence.
I didn't mean it as impertinence, and I don't think Lady Harriet took it as such.
You can't know anything about it. She can put on any kind of manner.
Squire Hunley.
Thank you. Show him in. How nice.
Good day to you, ladies. Mrs. Gibson, ma'am.
Squire Hamley, how very nice of you to visit us at last. My husband is away from home at present, but I am sure that he would be as delighted to see you where he here as we are.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sure. Molly, we are all wrong at home. Osborne has lost the fellowship at Trinity he went back to try for. Then he's gone and failed miserably in his degree after all that he said and that his mother said, and I, like a fool, went and boasted about my clever son. I can't understand it. I never expected anything extraordinary from Roger. But Osborne? And then it has thrown Madam into one of her bad fits of illness, and she seems to have a fancy for you, child. Your father came to see her this morning. She's very poorly, I'm afraid. She told him how she would like to have you about her, and he said I might fetch you. You'll come, won't you, my dear?
I'll be ready in 10 minutes. I will go now.
My dear, where are you going?
Mrs. Hamley wants me, and Papa says I may go.
My wife is ill. She begged Mr. Gibson to allow Molly to come to the hall.
Stop a minute, darling. I am sure dear Papa quite forgot that you were to go out with me tonight to visit people with whom I am quite unacquainted, and it is very uncertain if Mr. Gibson can return home in time to accompany me. So you see, Squire Hamley, I cannot allow Molly to go with you.
But well, ma'am, I shouldn't have thought it would have signified. Brides are always brides, I suppose, and it's their part to be timid, but I shouldn't have thought in this case. And my wife sets her heart on things as sick people do. Well, Molly, we must put it off till tomorrow, it seems, and it's our loss, not yours. You'll be as gay as can be tonight, I dare say.
No, I shall not. I never wanted to go, and now I want it less than ever.
Hush. It is wrong in you, Molly, my dear, to speak against such kind friends of your father's, as I understand these Cockerels are. Don't give so bad an impression of yourself to the kind, Squire.
Let her alone, let her alone. I see what she means. She'd rather come and be in my wife's sick room than go out for this visit tonight. Now, is there no way of getting her off?
None whatever. An engagement is an engagement with me, and I consider that she is not only engaged to Mr. Cockerell, but to me, bound to accompany me in my husband's absence.
Well, there's no use. Poor madam, she won't like it. She'll be disappointed. But it's but for one evening. But for one evening. She may come tomorrow, mayn't she? Or will the dissipation of such an evening be too much for her?
She will be ready at any time you name. I am so sorry. My foolish shyness is at fault. But still, you must acknowledge that an engagement is an engagement.
Did I ever say an engagement was an elephant, madam? However, there's no use saying any more about it, or I shall forget my manners. I'm an old tyrant, and she lying there in bed has always given me my own way. So you'll excuse me, Mrs. Gibson, won't you? And let Molly come along with me at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Certainly, my dear Squire, certainly.
Then I'll take my leave.
Oh, but Squire... But, Mama...
No, my dear, I must never have you exposing me to the ill manners of such a man again. I don't call him a squire. I call him a boor, or a yeoman at best. You must not go on accepting or rejecting invitations as if you were an independent young lady, Molly. Pay me the respect of a reference to my wishes another time, if you please, my dear.
Past that, I might go.
As I am now your mamma, your references must be to me for the future. But as you are to go, you may as well look well-dressed. I will lend you my new shawl for this visit and my set of green ribbons. I am always indulgent when proper respect is paid to me. And in such a house as Hamley Hall, no one can tell you may be coming and going, even if there is sickness in the family.
Thank you, but I don't want the shawl. There will be nobody there except the family, and there never is. I think, now that she is so ill.
What can I do for you to bring you back into good temper? First, you insist on knowing Lady Harriet better than I do. Then you jump at invitations without ever consulting me or thinking of how awkward it would be for me to go stumping into a drawing room all by myself, following my new name, too, which always makes me feel uncomfortable. It is such a sad come-down after Kirkpatrick. And then, when I offer you some of the prettiest things I have got, you say it does not signify how you are dressed. What can I do to please you, Molly? I, who delight in nothing more than peace in a family, to see you sitting there with despair upon your face.
Molly could stand it no longer. She went upstairs to her own room and began to cry. She thought of Mrs. Hamley wearying for her, of the old hall, whose very quietness might become oppressive to an ailing person, of the trust the squire had had in her that she would leave directly with him. And all this oppressed her much more than the querulousness of her stepmother's words.
In the third episode of Elizabeth Gaskell's Wives and Daughters, dramatized in 9 episodes by Barry Campbell, the part of Molly Gibson was played by Catherine Hurlbut, Claire, Angela Pleasance, Mr. Gibson, Tom Wilkinson, Squire Hamley, Robert Lang, Mrs. Hamley, Lilias Walker, Osborne, Adam Barham, Roger, Michael Troughton, Lady Cumnor, Pauline Letts, Lord Cumnor, Carrie Francis, Lady Harriet, Marion Diamond. Mr. Preston, Brett Usher, Miss Browning, Diana Bishop, Miss Phoebe, Hilda Schroeder, maid, Carol Boyd, and Thelma Whiteley was Mrs. Gaskell. The music was composed by Rachel Portman, and the director was Jane Morgan.